You're listening to the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show, and I'm your host, Heather Vail. Today I'm speaking with Andy Bischel, President and CEO of the Boys and Girls Clubs of Southern Nevada, and also Nicole Snitzhavel, Director of Clubhouse Operations. Andy and Nicole oversee the operation of 13 clubhouses, serving approximately 1,500 youth in Clark County each day. With more than 25 years of philanthropy and nonprofit leadership experience, Andy began his developmental career at the UNLV Athletic Department. He then served as Director of Development for the Animal Foundation, operating Nevada's largest animal shelter and adoption center. Andy and Nicole, thank you both for being here today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So, when exactly was the Boys and Girls Clubs of Southern Nevada founded?
1959.
Wow.
In fact, there's a pretty fun fact. Our very first club was in the basement of the Silver Nugget Casino. Only in Vegas, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Bill Boyd and Jackie Gaughan were some of our founding members, and they were the ones that really got the club started.
So now a lot of people think the Boys and Girls Club is just for after-school programs. What is the Boys and Girls Clubs of Southern Nevada summer program?
Yeah, I like to simplify it. When school's out, we're in, right?
Okay.
So that means all breaks before and after school, but also anytime school's out, we want to be available to the kids and for working families.
When does the summer program run and what are the hours of it?
We started this week and we start as early as 7 a.m. and we close the clubs at 6 p.m. and that's Monday through Friday.
So basically it's like an all day, every day kind of summer camp sort of thing.
Absolutely. We start with safe, right? We build safe communities, both emotionally and physically safe. And then the next ingredient is fun. So we want it to be loud and a place where all the kids can really just be themselves. Again, if they feel safe, they feel part of the group, then all of the other learning and fun can happen. So it is really, we want to start with fun and then we mix in the learning as we go. But it's not necessarily, it can be academic learning. Certainly we'll do some academic fulfillment during the summer. So summer brain gain is a big one. So we try to keep the kids reading levels up during those breaks. But it's really social emotional learning in that they're learning character and leadership along with that. What are social norms? How do kids regulate those social norms? So we like to say there's not rules at the Boys and Girls Clubs, they're norms. We want the kids to come up with what is acceptable, but they also have a hand in enforcing that as well. So it's really about giving those kids the opportunity to lead peers, certainly. So the athletic kid gets to lead in the gym and demonstrate their leadership capabilities there. And then when they switch to the art room, the artistic child gets to step up and show some leadership there and showcase their talents. And then there's academic and technology settings where kids that have those skills can really step up and lead the group. But again, it's a place where you get to lead and be led, depending on, you know, where that is. And that, again, really creates those social norms, that sense of belonging, how everybody gets along. And that is the essence of what Boys and Girls Club is. It's really building that character and leadership component in these kids so that they understand how to get along in a group. And when the opportunity to lead happens, then they're ready for it.
What would you say sets apart the Boys and Girls Club's summer program from other summer programs or camps for kids and teens?
I think some of it is the intentionality around what I just spoke about, the character and leadership, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's specifically built. We do this throughout the year. So it's interesting. Some kids are here really all the way through the year. Some, because they're not in school anymore, we're getting a whole new set of kids that come in for the summer. Right. Mm-hmm. They might live next to the clubs and they come, or their parents drop them off at the clubs. So it just really is a mix of kids, but it's the intentionality of the programming that the staff deliver around very specific items that we want them to get to. So academic success is a pillar of our programming. So we want to mix in some of those academic components, again, in fun ways, we'll practice math with card games, right? We can do those kind of things. But then also healthy lifestyles is another component of it. So there's the physical health piece of, you know, being active and running around and those kind of things, but also want to teach them, what does a healthy diet look like? How do you make healthy choices around that diet? Those pieces and parts of programming. And then again, that third pillar goes back to that character and leadership. So we're very intentional around those three pillars of programming. And again, want to make sure that there's activities around that, right? Activities meaning fun, that they're engaged and they can even push through things that they don't necessarily have skills around. Again, that's why we want those that have the skills, go ahead and demonstrate and help teach the other kids how to do those things. That's really, I think, what sets us apart from other camps.
Okay. What are the age ranges that kids can be in order to take part?
Yeah, 6 to 18. So what we call the littles are those 6 to 12s, and then the teens are the 13 to 18. And we separate those, that programming. That programming changes for the teens and the littles, so that we've got to entertain the teens a little bit more. but it's great, because what I love about the teens is they're making a choice to come through that door every day. A lot of them aren't dropped off, right? They're coming around because their friends are here, or they want the gym time, or those kind of things. We don't really care. We just want them to come. So have a place where they can socialize and have fun and, you know, do some activities, play in the gym, whatever it is, Xbox, all those things. It's just a positive place for them to be and really find some either new friends or join their friends that are already here.
Okay. Tell me more about the road trip across America theme and how that gets implemented into the programming.
Of course, we want to reinforce learning, and what better way is to kind of teach the kids about our own country and how we can weave in the different cultures and different food and different just fun facts about our country as a whole. So the road trip is going to incorporate all different aspects, whether that's theme parks, ballparks, the different lakes and natural resources that we have, as well as the different locations that we have as far as like national parks. And then from there in the clubhouse every week, we have a theme and we design a lot of our programs to be around it. So for example, we want to make sure that all of our different programs relate back to the theme. So when it's like theme park week, we'll have STEM activities where the kids get to create their own different theme parks using recycled goods or different things of that sort. And then we'll tailor each of those activities based on the age group. So maybe the 6 through 8 year olds may focus on drawing that activity versus the older kids actually creating it and making it come to life. So it's just a way to make that learning fun, learn a little bit more about our own country, and spice things up and kind of weave our programs together.
Okay. How much does a summer program cost to attend?
So to become a member, if you are ages 6 to 12, it is a $35 enrollment fee, which is good for the entire annual year. And from there, it's $80 a week. And then if you're a teenager for ages 13 to 18, it's a $20 annual fee. And after that, there are no additional fees, but we do have different financial aid options available.
Wow. Okay. So beyond being between 6 and 18 years old, what are the criteria for the kids to be able to take part in the program?
There's no specific criteria.
Is it just open to everybody?
Yeah.
Okay. So nothing except they want to come, they want to have fun, they want to learn, and they want to be part of the Boys and Girls Clubs, and that's it, right?
Yes, there's a couple questions on our application, but other than that, we're ready and open for anyone and everyone that wants to come.
Okay. Now, when you say the membership lasts for the whole year, what does that look like when the summer program's over?
So they can continue attending the clubhouse up until December 31st of the calendar year. We will have to have them re-enroll if they want to continue next year, which will be starting January 1st. But they're good to go to any clubhouse, all 13 clubhouses in Southern Nevada, with their annual membership.
Okay.
And the fee structure does change a bit during the academic year, but it actually decreases a bit. But it's, again, we want to make sure that the teens really have that incentive to come back. So the $20 membership fee, and you can come all year. We really want to encourage our teens to show up at the club, because it is such a positive place for them. And we want to, the ultimate outcome for our kids is a high school diploma, but with a plan. What is the plan for their future? If it's post-secondary education, We want to help them, guide them to colleges. We do college tours. We help them with college applications, Pell Grants, those kind of things. And if they don't see college in their future, what are their other opportunities for employment? So if there's a technical schools or job opportunities, how do we help them get prepared for the workforce?
Are meals included, or do they need to bring their own breakfast and lunch to the club?
Youth are more than welcome to bring their own meals. However, most of our clubhouses do serve breakfast, and all 13 clubhouses serve lunch.
Okay. Besides, obviously, the 13 clubhouses being in different locations around the valley, what are the key differences among them? Are there like certain characteristics that, you know, this club is for this and that club's for that? Or do they all just kind of run the same program and it's based on location?
Programming looks very similar across them. I would say they change per neighborhood, right? Each club really reflects its neighborhood, both culturally, ethnically, and they're not all the same size. So there are some clubs that are over 60,000 feet and have multiple gyms and those kind of things. And then we have some clubs that are about 4,000 square feet, right? So they're very small, and they each have their own character. If we don't have a gym, it's really hard to do basketball, right? So those kind of things pick up at different places. But I would think, you know, the biggest thing is really that cultural feeling of their neighborhood, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay. So if someone lives like kind of an equal distance between two clubs and they can't decide which one they should go to, is there an opportunity to check them out or take a tour before they decide?
Yeah, we love when people come in and do tours. We ever since COVID, right? Everyone, you know, kind of shut down a little bit. But now that, you know, a lot of the different restrictions have lessened, we love to bring our families in. We would love to give them tours. A lot of times they're youth led, they're member led. So our members show them around, show them the programs that we do, the different areas of the program, introduce them to the staff. We want to make sure that all of the families feel comfortable knowing where their kids are going and what they're doing every day.
So how can people register for the Boys and Girls Clubs of Southern Nevada Summer Program, or check out the different locations, or just find out more about the organization in general?
They can go online to bgcsnv.org. On there, we have all 13 locations listed. And if they're already ready to join a club and know what location, they can go ahead and sign up online and they can complete the application, and our clubhouses will reach out to them once they receive that digital application.
Okay. So once again, bgcsnv.org for Boys and Girls Club, Southern Nevada, bgcsnv.org. They list all 13 clubhouses on the website, or you can find out more information. And is there anything else that you think it's important for listeners to know about either the summer program or the Boys and Girls Clubs in general before we go?
No, I think we really kind of covered it, but it's... You know, we've been serving the community for a long time, and it was really an important organizational stance to stay open during COVID. That was a big lift for us, and we're getting through that, and everybody's kind of fighting back to that normalcy. But we learned a lot from staying open during COVID, and the support we received from the county to really make sure that we have the equipment to keep our clubs clean and safe has really elevated our service that much more.
Awesome. Okay, so bgcsnv.org. If you want to find out more about the Boys and Girls Clubs of Southern Nevada, sign up for the summer program, choose a location. It's all there. Great organization, bgcsnv.org. And Andy and Nicole, I want to thank you both for being here and sharing more information about the programs with our listeners. It's been great. So thank you.
Thanks, Heather.
Thanks.
If you love them enough to listen to them practice the same song on tuba,
please be done.
Over and over and over and over and over. Then surely you'll check nhtsa.gov/the right seat to make sure they're correctly buckled in the back seat.
Sounds good, honey.
Check today at nhtsa.gov/the right seat. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
You're listening to the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. I'm your host, Heather Vail, and joining me is Jesse Toprak, Chief Analyst with electric vehicle provider Autonomy. Jesse's a longtime auto industry analyst whose background includes time with Edmunds, TrueCar, Cars.com, and CarHub. Now with the increasing price of gas, he's been analyzing the future of the EV industry. Jesse, thank you for being here today.
Thanks for having me, Heather.
So what exactly is autonomy?
Autonomy is an electrical vehicle subscription service. We like to say that it is the fastest, cheapest, and easiest way to drive a Tesla. At the moment, we have Tesla 3s available for subscription in California, but quickly expanding nationwide. The idea is to enable more consumers to have access to EVs at a more affordable overall out-of-pocket cost, and do this in the easiest and fastest way. As you might know, there are long waiting lists for a lot of these EVs at the moment due to high demand. Mm-hmm. Some of them you have to wait not just weeks, sometimes months. Some of them actually, if you go order a Tesla X today, you might get an order delivery estimation for next year. It's that long. So our service enables potential EV customers to get access to these vehicles in a much cheaper and faster way.
Okay. Now, obviously, Tesla is one of the front runners in the space, but now a lot of the vehicle manufacturers do have EVs, from Ford to Volkswagen to Hyundai and Kia and pretty much everything in between. And obviously, there's a lot of different ways. The subscription service sounds super cool and brand new. There's also leasing, there's buying, there's renting if you want to. But however people get the vehicle, there are some hesitancies sometimes with not really having full trust in the charging network and whether I can get from point A to point B without running out of my charge and, you know, being stranded in the middle of nowhere. Whereas with a gas vehicle, people pretty much know you can find a gas station almost anywhere. There are times when there's a long stretch of freeway in the middle of nowhere where you could conceivably run out of gas and get lost. But it's a bigger concern with the charging network. What other factors do you think are influencing more mainstream adoption of electric vehicles?
Heather, just like you mentioned, the lack of adequate infrastructure for charging stations is a concern. It's one of the primary concerns, in fact, of potential consumers who are looking at getting an EV, perhaps, but hesitating. The other one is what we call the EV premium. So how much more an electric vehicle costs in comparison to its gas engine counterpart is what we'll call premium. And that's good news, is that that's declining, even though it's still more expensive in general to buy an EV. As more models come to the marketplace, we're going to see that premium coming down. But the charging station concern is a real one, along with the range anxiety. So if you sum it up, you have the charging station, EV premium, and range anxiety as the top three reasons why people will be, taking another second to think about getting an EV. Good news is that all those are improving to hopefully promote a larger adoption of electric vehicles across the nation. What we see now is a lot of city to federal level incentives for not only just buying or leasing an EV, but also installation of charging stations. And this differs quite a bit from city level to a state. So it's best to check where you live with the city. A lot of cities now actually have incentives for installation of charging stations at home, as well as small businesses. So I'll give you an example where we have our headquarters for autonomy in Santa Monica, California. The city of Santa Monica offers small businesses $2,000 to install a charging station. So those kind of arrangements are actually, if you think about it, really win-win-win for everybody, because as this, how we drive changes over the next, couple of decades inevitably, and transform the auto industry in a way that we've never really seen since the Model T in 1908, we're going to have to adapt to new ways of driving our vehicles and charging them. As that happens, this creates an opportunity for small businesses too. So if you have, let's say, a coffee shop or a restaurant, you are probably more likely to get customers in the future if you have a charging station installed in your parking lot. And if the city is giving incentive for this, That's great. And also, there are a lot of private charging networks now that will pay the business owner a revenue share arrangement, so they can actually make money off the revenue that is generated by the charging station that's located in their business. So there are creative arrangements out there. Clearly, we're at the beginning of the journey, though.
Yeah. Well, one of the cool things about Las Vegas is it's a relatively small area. So if someone were to have an EV that they charge at home and they live and work within the Las Vegas Valley, I would say chances are they can go from day to day to day without really having to use any external charging stations unless they're doing rideshare or that sort of thing. But, you know, overall, how many more charging stations do we need across the country to make EV adoption viable or more viable as a mainstream choice?
You're right. So the actual number is hard to pin down because it needs to be in correlation to number of EVs on the road. So the best way to look at this is that, do we have enough charging stations where if you're in a hurry, you can go and you don't have to wait in line to get into charging station, and that there's so many of them that you don't have to travel miles to find one. And if you think about this, right, especially for Vegas, and you're right, I actually did test out a pure EV in Tesla for a week in Vegas. And it was one of the easier places to have an EV for the reasons you mentioned. It's a relatively small radius and a lot of stop-and-go traffic, which EVs like, because every time you brake, there's a regenerative braking that generates energy. So it's really perfect for it. And then you have access to year-round sunshine, obviously.
Yeah.
So if you have some solar panel arrangements,
exactly,
you can literally have a free car. It's almost perfect for it. And, you know, it doesn't get too cold. So there's that battery performance degradation in the cold climates. It doesn't quite apply except for maybe a few days a year.
Yeah.
So it's great. So what we need to do here is a couple of things. First, the apartment buildings is an issue. This multi-unit dwellings where, you know, quite a few people live. And in Vegas, there's obviously areas where these are concentrated. Luckily, in Vegas, there's a lot more single-family homes, I think, if you look at it per capita. Just yeah. because of the land available. So it's not as much of an issue there, but still nationwide is a problem because if you have a big apartment unit with 50 different apartments in it, there are no chargers, there's only one or two, now what? So that's a problem. I think the solution is couple-fold. So again, this incentives for businesses needs to be there, but also we need to have charging stations just like you'll have parking meters on busy streets in big cities. So if you have charging, you know, stationed right on the street as a street park, there's no better solution to that. So as this gets wider and wider adoption, I think you're going to see that charging stations on the streets popping up a lot more frequently. They're also big businesses completely transforming how they see the marketplace, incorporating charging stations into their business plans for the future. For example, Starbucks, I see them as the gas station of the future, or establishments like Starbucks. You go in, it's perfect. You can go sit down, have a coffee for half an hour. You can usually within half an hour, if they have fast chargers, you can tap off 50% or more, depending on the battery you have, the car you have. And then on your way, you pay a couple of bucks to charge it at Starbucks. That's extra money for them. You don't have to worry about where to charge your car, you get your coffee and go. So I think we're going to see how we drive, how we charge our cars changing quite dramatically over the next decade. And, you know, hopefully we'll have this conversation in a decade. It's going to be a completely different picture of car ownership in the U.S.
Yeah, exactly. And I think pretty much every Walmart now has charging networks, don't they?
Correct. Walmart, pretty much any large chain of supermarkets, drugstores, and this is at the beginning of it. So you're not going to be able to get away from it. I think the excuse of I don't want to get an EV because I don't live close to a charger will not really be relevant. And also, as you said too, so most EVs today, when we average it out, all available EVs in the US for sale today, they get about 250-mile range per charge. Average driver in the U.S. drives about 14,600 miles a year, which turns out to be just around 300 miles a week. So we're right there almost already. So, and that's the average today. It's rapidly increasing. You look at a vehicle like Lucid, it gets 500 miles Granted, it's not cheap. The one model available now is about $140,000. I guess if you're paying $140,000, you're not terribly worried about gas prices, et cetera. But so the point is that the range are increasing. So once we get to the point of where the average for an EV is 300 miles plus, that's what people drive anyway. And once a week, charging somewhere in a fast charger for an hour or two is really not that much worse than going to a gas station and getting gas on your car.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, you did introduce a little bit of a chicken and egg scenario there, because if the network won't expand until more people get vehicles, but people don't want to get vehicles until the network expands, you know, we kind of find ourselves in a catch-22 with that. But you made some good points as to why it is viable for a lot of people. What plans do you think there are to expand the plug and charge network over the next few years?
Well, we have the $5 billion commitment plan from Biden in terms of expanding the charging infrastructure around the U.S., and that's already on its way. So we see this a lot whenever there's an emerging technology or sector where we get stuck in this chicken and egg scenario. Governmental incentives can help accelerate that adoption and give impetus to growth. And that's what we're seeing too. I'm not terribly crazy about subsidizing everything to keep it healthy. But I think just like giving people a leg up when they get first getting started and getting them on their way, there's some benefit to that as well in the scenario, especially in an industry that isn't necessarily extremely profitable yet. EV charging is not yet profitable. Selling EVs aren't profitable either. But we know that it will be. So somebody needs to come in here and pick up the slack, and city, state, and federal government incentives are trying to make up for that at the moment. And I think there are a decent level of incentives that's going to promote this. So one is the incentives on the vehicles themselves. The other one is the incentives on the charging networks. And we're seeing that incentives applied as well, but it's not uniform. Like I was looking at Utah, for example, which is obviously the neighbor there. For you, yep. For when they actually charge EVs an extra fee for using the roads, which makes no sense at all. So, interestingly, they have some of the highest EV adoption per capita still. So that means that the demand is probably more than what the government wants to see. That point is, this is an inevitable transformation, and the areas, the cities that recognize this and transforms themselves can actually attract more people coming in. I can tell you that the last time I stayed in Vegas, I actually looked for a hotel that had a charger in it, because I was coming in with an EV. I was testing one out. So if you have the situation, I actually went to the one that had a Tesla. I think it was Caesars had a Tesla charger. So I ended up going there, and they take your car and charge it for you. And we take it out of LA, it's charged. So this is the other thing. It's not, obviously, Vegas is there because of tourism mostly. And if you can appeal to people that are coming in with their EVs, and they know that they don't have to go anywhere to charge, there's one at the hotel. So the hotel adoption, particularly for the Strip and in Vegas, is extremely important. I don't think there's enough. I even know in some of the best hotels only have a few chargers available.
Yeah.
So that needs to be something that the hotel chains needs to pay more attention to, I think.
Yeah, all of the casinos up and down the Strip tend to have chargers as well. And in fact, the EVs get premium parking spots. So it's like those 10 spaces or whatever it is closest to the elevator or closest to the walkway into the casino, those are the spots that have the chargers and are reserved only for EVs. So Vegas is encouraging it, at least, as an option.
Yeah, that's yet another reason to get an EV, right? Get to this parking spot. I gotta tell you, there's something that feels good about it in general. And if people never experienced it, I highly encourage you to get a test drive. Because if you're in one of these, you know, high-tech EVs today, any kind of a Tesla, really any EV today, it's almost not fair to gas engine vehicles the way they drive. It's a whole different experience. And once people drive it, like in a Tesla 3 Plaid, you can get 0 to 60 in 1.9 seconds. That is bonkers. That is neck breaking speed. It's almost unnecessary, but it is good to know.
I used to think that electric vehicles would kind of feel like a toy when you're driving them. Like you get in and it's not going to really feel like a car. It's going to feel more like a wind up car or something. Mm-hmm. But in fact, they do actually feel like regular cars. And They even have noises implemented into them to make them sound like a gas car. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah, I think they need to have some sort of a noise for pedestrian safety. So there's the federal regulations require if they go below 25 miles an hour and when they're reversing, because there actually had been many accidents, unfortunately, even before Pure EVs and Toyota Prius were so popular, if you remember the hybrid. And they were basically almost, you know, they have no sound when they're going low speeds and they'll run into pedestrians. So there's some requirements from it, but it is an eerie experience that there's no roaring engine sound when you're accelerating to, you know, 60 miles an hour in 2 seconds. Mm-hmm. That's almost, it doesn't feel real. But technology is as best as you can get today. Most of the EVs, along with that, comes a lot of safety features that are standard, that are well beyond any luxury brand's gas engine coolants today. So you're getting a lot of car for your money. But I would say the biggest benefit now, and I think it'll be a mistake for me to not mention it, is the savings from gas, especially given the gas prices now.
Yeah.
You know, I'm in LA and it's not unusual for me to see gas prices at $7 a gallon around here. So if you're doing that, and if you're hitting the US average, as we said, about 300 miles per week in driving, you're probably spending around at least $100 a week in gas today, sometimes more. If you have a larger vehicle, you know, gas guzzler, you're commuting a lot of miles. Some people spend $1,000 a month or more, but $400 or $500 seems to be average. Well, if I can subscribe to, say, a Tesla 3 at autonomy at $409 a month, and I was paying $500 a month in gas before, that's essentially a free car.
Yeah.
It's almost a no-brainer. So when you do the math, and then there's the cost of charging, but tends to be really, if you have access to a home charging or a supercharging network, and you're doing it off peak times, your electricity cost can be as little as 1/10, sometimes even less than a gas car. So if you're spending $500 a month in gas, you might end up spending about maybe $50 a month in electricity cost.
Okay. Now let's talk a little bit more about the premium that you mentioned earlier. So obviously there's some very attractive tax incentives for people who choose to buy rather than subscribe or whatever other options there are. But you mentioned the electric vehicle premium. They're still very expensive compared to gas vehicles for the initial purchase or lease of the car. And I mean, obviously over time, that's going to work out because of all the maintenance savings, the gas savings and whatever. But from an environmental standpoint, it seems like the powers that be would want everyone driving an electric vehicle because it's so much better for the environment and so many other things. Who is it that's implementing the premium who's saying, we're going to raise the bar and make it difficult for you to actually get into this electric vehicle, and we're going to put a premium on it so that it costs you more, so you're going to think twice?
Right. I don't think that's the intention. It just happens to be what ends up being as a market reality, meaning the cost for making EVs now is significantly higher than the gas counterparts, mostly due to the cost of the batteries. A lot of the EVs, about half of their cost is the cost of battery.
Wow.
Because the rest of the car is pretty much the same car, right? The chassis and everything else.
Yeah.
In fact, the EVs have a much more simplified mechanics, if you look at it. There comes the advantage, long-term advantage of very low cost of maintenance. There are no spark plugs. There's really nothing to change. There's no oil changes. It just goes and goes. But problem is the cost of battery that goes into it initially is very high still, and that keeps the price high up. So I don't think the automakers are intentionally trying to price gouge. It's basically they're trying to figure out a price point that makes sense for them to sell the vehicle at that brings them some sort of revenue, but also consumers will be still, will be like to pull the trigger on their vehicle.
Yeah.
Now, what we're seeing here is gradual introduction of many new different models. We're actually not seeing the specific vehicle prices coming down. Meaning, if I were to look at a Tesla 3 prices last 3 years, it's actually going up, meaning or the original MSRP. It's not like they're lowering the price. And what is more interesting is the used version of popular EVs like the Tesla 3 is selling today for more than when they originally sold as new vehicles. So, wow. For example, you know, 2019 model Tesla 3 that had an MSRP, you know, sticker price of $45,000 when it sold 2 years ago, brand new, now sells for almost $55,000. So it's a $10,000 more price, market price. Yeah. So this is very unusual, very much unusual. That means, but why does that happen, right? If it's not going to happen, if the people didn't care
supply
about
the car, and demand.
Exactly. Yeah. You got it. Yeah. So huge demand, low supply. This is what happens. So which proves that price is necessarily wrong. It just means that there are not that many cars out there. So it's really, for me, it's a supply-driven equation, which will resolve itself with the introduction of more and more vehicles. Now, we have to talk about Tesla, and we'll talk about EVs, and simply because of the function of their market share. Their market share in the U.S. now is around 70%. So 7 out of 10 EVs sold today in the United States are Teslas. Based on the predictions we have, that is not going to last forever. In fact, by next year this time, Tesla will lose their majority market share in the U.S. It's going to dip right below 50% due to many, many EVs hitting starting this fall, especially into next year. Now, that's not necessarily all bad news for Tesla because the pot itself is going to get much larger. So their sales actually go climbing still. It's just that there's just going to be so many more vehicles. So the point with that is, as we get more vehicles coming into marketplace from, you know, legacy automakers like General Motors, Ford, we're going to see the prices level off. We're going to see more variety of vehicles sitting in the marketplace. Also will help with this adoption. I should mention probably the most significant EV introduction that we're seeing this year and on is the Ford F-150 Lightning truck. And that is significant. Yes, because Ford F-150 is the best-selling truck across the world. It's a huge profit maker for Ford. And it appeals to a clientele that doesn't necessarily think about getting an EV as the first thing in their mind. Small businesses, middle of the country, you know, truck country, that are your Ford buyers, and they're very loyal to the brand. So once they go over the hump of getting used to an EV, the concept of knowing an EV, we're talking tens of thousands of vehicles potentially being sold and changing the landscape of the truck ownership. And that's going to be significant because it's going to bring in clients that are not necessarily just environmentally friendly. They want to be the early adopters, you know, upper middle class, more affluent client. It's going to go to that small business class and truly expand the appeal of EVs.
Interesting. So you mentioned the battery being the majority of the cost of an EV. So I start thinking, well, okay, I know in my cars, especially in the hot climate of the Southwest, I go through batteries in my normal car, you know, at least once a year or once every 2 years, it'll die just because of the heat, just because of the wear and tear. How long do the batteries last in an EV? And what would happen if the majority of the cost of your EV is the battery and the battery suddenly dies?
Okay, so the most manufacturers have lifetime warranty on their battery. Some have it 10 years, 100,000 miles, but a lot of them will have a lifetime warranty on the battery just for that reason, because people are hesitant to make a purchase that where, you know, the biggest cost of the car may just go off on you one day. So from that perspective, I don't think consumers have much to worry about in terms of protection of the warranty on the battery. In terms of how long they last, the long-term tests shown by Tesla is that once you get to about 100,000 miles, the degradation is actually very small, maybe about 5%. Hmm. And in fact, in my previous job, we were looking at a fleet arrangement. If we were to keep these vehicles, say, for an Uber service, a Tesla 3 is up to 300,000 miles, what will happen? Batteries actually, at least in theory, can last that long without a problem with maybe 10 to 15% degradation. Now, what we don't know is this. I don't think anybody's driven an EV in, say, Vegas hot summers for 200,000 miles yet.
Right.
So it's one of those things like we can predict where it's going to land, but real life, it's completely different sometimes than simulations. And you are right. You know, if it's 115 degrees, you have to blast the battery all day long and you have to stop and go traffic. that should have some degradation on it. But we really haven't seen, good news is that we really haven't seen a major degradation in battery performance in heat. Batteries tend to do, these batteries, particularly the lithium ion batteries, that's in most EVs today, they don't like cold much at all. So if you go to, you know, snowbelt regions, you go to Minnesota, that's probably a worse problem they have in terms of owning an EV than the one you have in Vegas. The heat is a little bit better. Now, extreme heat is still not good, obviously. They're like, you know, if you ask the EVs, it'll tell you 75 and, you know, nice every day. They'll be perfect for them. But the point is, I don't think it's going to have a great impact on performance. And we also need to keep in mind that we're at the very beginning of this journey. The batteries will change. There are new technologies, battery technologies. One of them is called a solid-state battery, where it doesn't get impacted by temperature almost at all. And there's very little degradation. The battery itself is about 40% lighter, and it can be made cheaper once you get the economies of scale. So what we see now, today, is not the end product, is my point. And it's going to continually improve. Because if you think about it as this, right, all of these car companies, they're there to make money. Right now, they're not making money. Nobody's making money on EVs. Tesla started to make money recently in terms of actual profit from the vehicle. But now this is all major capital investment, billions of dollars from all auto manufacturers across the globe, legacy ones that we know have been around for decades, and new ones that are popping out. They're all spending billions. So the hope is that there's going to be a major leap in better technology and range, performance under extreme heat or cold, and the price point are all going to resolve themselves as we have a wider adoption.
Okay. So how can people find out more about EVs and the logistics of the EV charging network and make that decision for themselves about whether they see an EV in their own future?
Many cities have their municipalities or their public utilities network have a map of all available charging stations. So if you just simply search for, you know, Las Vegas charging stations, you're going to see the first couple ones are going to come up as government-funded sites that shows you where these charging stations are at. There are many sources at autonomy.com. There are several blog pieces that we put out to help people understand EVs if they have any questions. There are a lot of very consumer-friendly articles that tells them the challenges in owning an EV and how easy they are to be resolved. Charging stations, etc. The other thing I was going to say is that when we look at where people charge their cars, U.S. average today is 80% of all EV owners charge at home at night. So when we talk about this charging network problem, it's really not a problem for everybody. In fact, most people are fine. They have a charging station at home. So we're talking about the 20% that we need to bring in through installation of more publicly available charging networks, which is being worked on now. What I will say is this, if you want to get an EV, there are really no big excuses now. As long as you can afford an average ICE vehicle, you know, they're a gas engine car, you probably can afford an EV. It's one of the missions of the services like Autonomy too. If you don't, you know, don't have $50,000 to buy one, just go and subscribe. And the benefit of that is this, you know, subscribing, whether it's through Autonomy, I like the subscription model in general, because what it does is it enables the consumer to have a very much extended test drive. That way, you can actually, without committing a lot of money, you know, getting into a big contract with a finance contract or paying a lot of cash out of pocket or a three-year lease term commitment, you can actually just subscribe for a vehicle for, say, 3 months, truly test the vehicle out in your own daily life, in your own commute, and then see if it works for you. And if it works, great. You can keep it. If not, at least you know without making a big commitment.
Yeah. And when do you expect that would be available to Las Vegas?
We're hoping later this year. And when that happens, maybe I'll back on again and tell you more about it. But they're working diligently. Now, the challenge is, just like any other consumer is trying to get an EV, our biggest challenge is to get a hold of cars to, you know, have on our system. So we're working diligently. Right now also, it's only Tesla 3s, but we're expanding rapidly to other brands. So the goal really will be to have multiple vehicles available for different price points and different class of vehicles, say a small compact car to an SUV to a truck for full available model variety in the future.
Okay, Nice. So autonomy.com, if you want to find out more about that, or if you want to access some of the educational resources they have there. I will mention that the subscription model, if you're a rideshare driver, if you drive for Uber or Lyft or whatever, the autonomy subscription model is not for that. It's for personal use. But I also found out yesterday that Hertz has a rent a Tesla and drive for Uber option, which in Las Vegas costs a little over $300 a week. So if you're renting it just for yourself, obviously that's going to be more expensive. But if your goal is to do rideshare and make some money driving, then that would be an option as well. And then obviously, if you're purchasing or leasing, there's various tax incentives that are available. And the main problem, as Jesse mentioned, is the stock. So it's really hard to get one right now. I'm actually waiting on one myself. But in the future, I think we're all going to be driving EVs, especially in Las Vegas, as we mentioned. You know, it makes so much sense. We've got sunshine over 300 days a year. You can have a solar system installed much more cost effectively than in the past. And you can use that to fuel, so to speak, your EV and drive for free, as Jesse mentioned, pretty much, you know. So, Jesse, I want to thank you so much for being here and discussing this with us and letting people know about the various options and the future of the industry. It's been really informational, and thank you for your time.
My pleasure, Heather. Thank you.
When you went car shopping, you meant business. You ace vehicle history searches and test drives. You out-salesman to the salesman. Now you've got your wheels. If you manage that, you can get your retirement plan on track. Visiting aceyourretirement.org can help. With 401k tips and smart savings strategies, you'll have the info you need to get more for your future. Go to aceyourretirement.org, because when it comes to speeding past financial challenges, you're an ace. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
This is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show, and I'm your host, Heather Vail. Joining me today is local fine artist Ken Klein, currently showing his works at the West Charleston Library in a show called Ken Klein's Still Life. This is an opportunity to see a collection of oil paintings spanning over 30 years, with proceeds from his art sales going to charity. Ken, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
How did you decide to become an artist in the first place?
I mean, I always was an artist, like as a kid, drawing, and I took art classes in high school, but I never really thought about, you know, becoming an artist. And then I just, when I was going to college, I just started taking some art classes, and I got into commercial art more than fine art. And then I finished as a fine artist at UNLV. Well, that's pretty much how I got started. And then from there, I tried to, you know, become an artist, which is very difficult, but I ended up finishing my career as a sign artist, doing sign works and pictorials and stuff back when billboards were hand painted.
With your paintings in particular, how would you describe your painting style?
My painting style is sharp focus, still life, which means that you're trying to paint it real. It's not really photorealism, because photorealism, you're looking at a photograph and trying to recreate the photograph as it is. I actually have the objects set up in front of me, so I have to spend a lot of time, you know, setting up still life and then preparing my panels, because I paint on wood and have to gesso those. It's a long ordeal just to get to the drawing on the panel. And so that's pretty much how I do it. But they are sharp focus still life with a trompe l'oeil, which means to fool the eye, you know, angle to some of the paintings. And that just means that some of the objects look kind of real when you see them from a distance. And then when you get up on them, you know, you check out the fine detail.
So how do you decide which elements you're going to compile into the scene that you then paint?
Pretty much the objects that I paint are things that have just been handed down from my grandparents, my parents, family members, and just things that I had as a kid and that I bought over my lifetime. I don't really go out searching for still life anymore. I just kind of use the stuff that we have around here. Lots of old antiquities. Sometimes it's newer things. And I just try to create a still life that I think would be interesting to the viewer, hoping it's interesting to me, and I'm painting, and I'm spending countless hours, which turn into weeks, which turn into months, on each painting. So that's pretty much how I get to the final piece that I'm working on.
So how long can people go and enjoy your art show at the West Charleston Library?
The actual exhibit will be there till July 5th. So April 26th to July 5th. And then I think they rotate it sometimes to other city library galleries. So it's a gallery system for the city of Las Vegas through the Las Vegas libraries. That's where they have the gallery set up at. I guess they actually won Best of Las Vegas Gallery through that review journal.
So what charities are you donating your proceeds to?
I donate to a number of charities myself personally, but the ones that I'm kind of trying to focus in on now are Catholic Charities, which is the one that Remain and Las Vegas Boulevard meet, where all the, it looks like they are inundated with a need. And a Cure for the Kids Station, that helps families in need that are cancer patients. And the Make-A-Wish Foundation, those are the three that I'm kind of focusing on now. I donate to them anyway, but this is if I get proceeds from any of the paintings. They can make their donation for the painting to that foundation. I'll donate my artwork.
Nice. Okay, and you mentioned that you used to do signs and billboards. What sorts of commercial art have you done around town that people might have seen and remember?
Probably the most common one would be I worked for the Las Vegas Stars and Las Vegas 51s for 34 years, so I painted those signs in the outfield all those years. So if they went to those baseball games, those AAA games at Cashman Field, they saw the some of my artwork, along with a lot of other little signs I did for them around the park. So that would probably be the easiest one. Other than that, I just worked for construction companies and different businesses. Aside from that, for my sign career, it was 40 years long. So,
wow, that's a long time. So where can people find out more about your work if they want to look online and see some of your paintings or some of the other stuff that you've done?
I have it on Facebook. It's under Ken Klein Fine Art. And I think if you go to Facebook and just go to that, Ken Klein Fine Art, I think it'll come up and it'll show some paintings there. I don't really have too many things other than that because I don't have like a online store or anything like that. You know, maybe that's in the future because a couple people have asked me about doing that. But other than that, they go to the show. My AOL number is there so they can contact me through that. So if they go to any of the exhibits, wherever they are, they can find my AOL number there to contact me if they need more information.
Okay. So it's at Ken Klein Fine Art on Facebook. And if you want to go to the show, it's at the West Charleston Library, which is 6301 West Charleston Boulevard. That's at the CSN campus between Jones and Torrey Pines. And that'll be running through to July. Ken Klein's Still Life Art Show. Ken, I want to thank you so much for being here today. It's been great talking to you, and hopefully people can go and see your work and maybe purchase some as well.
Right. I think they'll enjoy it. I mean, it's probably a little different than anything they've seen. So it'd be great to have people go out and check it out.
Hey, wouldn't it be great if life came with a remote control? You know, you could hit pause when you needed to, or hit rewind, like that time you knocked down that wasp's nest.
Uh-oh.
Well, life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome, but prediabetes does. With early diagnosis and a few healthy changes, you can stop prediabetes before it leads to type 2 diabetes. To learn your risk, take the 1-minute test today at doihaveprediabetes.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and its prediabetes awareness partners.
I'm Heather Vail with the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show, and this is your community events calendar for nonprofit initiatives and charity events around the valley. Monday's Dark is a bi-monthly musical fundraising party at The Space, with each event raising $10,000 for a specific charity in 90 minutes. Upcoming shows include this Monday, June 6th at 8 p.m., benefiting the Vegas Casino Canine Foundation, Monday, June 20th at 8 p.m., benefiting NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, Southern Nevada, and Monday, July 11th at 8 p.m., benefiting Rebuilding Together, Southern Nevada. Get tickets or find out more details at mondaysdark.com. The Bottega Exchange co-working space is hosting a networking fair with proceeds going to support Baby's Bounty on Saturday, June 11th from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. at Bottega Exchange. Baby's Bounty is a local nonprofit that supports and empowers at-risk families through education and essential tools for raising healthy babies. Find out more about the organization at babiesbounty.org and see all the event details at bottegaexchange.com. Ken Klein's Still Life Art Exhibit is showing through July 5th at the West Charleston Library, located on the CSN campus between Jones and Torrey Pines. Enjoy this local artist's hyper-realistic oil paintings featuring historical pop culture subjects. Proceeds from art sales are being donated to charity. Hockey stars from the Vegas Golden Knights and football stars from the Las Vegas Raiders will be facing off against each other to play softball. The third annual Battle for Vegas charity softball game will take place on Monday, July 18th at 7:30 p.m. at the Las Vegas Ballpark in downtown Summerlin. Watch Riley Smith of the Vegas Golden Knights and his teammates take on friends from the Las Vegas Raiders, with proceeds going to benefit the Vegas Golden Knights Foundation. Funds from the event will be distributed to two nonprofits, Community and Schools of Nevada, the state's leading dropout prevention organization, and the Maximum Hope Foundation, founded by comedian Brad Garrett to provide financial assistance for families of children dealing with critical, life-threatening illnesses. Buy your tickets or find out more details at battleforvegas.com. And the Nevada Wheelchair Foundation is giving out free wheelchairs to those who need them and can't afford them. To request a wheelchair or to help with the mission, visit NevadaWheelchairFoundation.org.
Adopt US Kids presents What to Expect When You're Expecting a Teenager. Learning the Lingo.
GOAT, G-O-A-T, acronym, stands for Greatest of All Time. As in, spaghetti sandwiches for dinner? They're my fave. Dad, you're the GOAT.
You don't have to speak teen to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care will love you just the same. Visit AdoptUSKids.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt U.S. Kids, and the Ad Council.